Everybody, welcome back.
It's me, Matt Tinney, and
Niels Rosenbaum. How are you?
Back in action. I'm doing well.
Good. It's good to be back.
What's happening,
Niels? Well, I'm back again. Yeah. This is my second.
You're back at it again.
Yes, I am.
I'm sure
that feeling better than ever.
We could put a whole bunch of songs in here.
That's back you in can action. Edit those in later.
Yeah, I do a lot of editing. Nope, I do not. So I'm glad that you're on the podcast.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, we actually got a question in.
Okay, good. What is it?
We got a question in from Steve.
Steve, okay.
And I don't know on this one, and this actually comes up a lot in classes.
Okay.
So, what comes first? Someone is diagnosed or living with schizophrenia.
Okay.
Or substance use.
Oh, that is an excellent question.
And this comes up a lot. And of course, I paraphrase that to use proper language, but...
You know, it's funny.
It's like the chicken or the egg kind of thing.
I just read an article about this.
Okay.
So they did a good review of the Danish people, I think it was. They keep really good records. They do. Better than
just
the Americans.
Just specifically. The Danish people.
Records. The Scandinavians keep very good records.
Okay.
Because they have socialized medicine, so they just track everybody. And so they were looking at people diagnosed with substance-related... psychosis. So not diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Say it again. Substance-related psychosis.
Yes. So substance-induced psychosis is what it's called.
Right. I got you now.
So if you have substance-induced psychosis, like you could be using LSD, although that just goes away. But alcohol can cause psychosis, which you don't see that much. Marijuana, obviously. Methamphetamines.
And you just said marijuana, obviously. I don't feel like anyone associates marijuana with psychosis.
Well, they should.
Really?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. People who have a risk for becoming schizophrenic are more likely to have schizophrenia if they smoke marijuana. So there's a certain
more likely
group
to
of,
have it or more likely to develop it?
Develop it. So there's a certain group of people who will become schizophrenic if they smoke marijuana that otherwise would not become schizophrenic.
But they have to have been predisposed, or no, predisposed.
We don't know exactly, but we know that people who smoke marijuana have higher rates of schizophrenia. It's not hugely higher.
Right.
A lot of people smoke marijuana, and they're not all getting schizophrenia.
Right.
But people who smoke marijuana are more likely to become schizophrenic.
Okay.
And we do know if you took all the people who have schizophrenia and none of them ever smoked marijuana, some of those people wouldn't be schizophrenic.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So going back to this article, so marijuana actually had the highest rate of becoming schizophrenia. So if you go to the hospital and you're diagnosed with substance-induced psychosis from marijuana, if they do a follow-up, it was like a 10-year follow-up.
Wow.
You have like a 50% chance of becoming schizophrenic or being diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Right.
Having that diagnosis change from substance-induced to actual schizophrenia. So that means half the people who become psychotic from smoking marijuana
develop schizophrenia.
And the other half don't. So, and most people don't become psychotic in the first place. Don't get me wrong. But if you're one of those people that becomes psychotic, you have a high rate of conversion to schizophrenia. It was interesting because it was lower for methamphetamines. I think it was closer to like 30%.
See, and just from my experience as in law enforcement on that, I would think completely opposite.
Yeah, I would have thought meth would be the highest.
Yeah, like people on any kind of meth or PCP or any kind of like stimulants like that.
Yeah.
And just talking with them.
Yeah.
I would have thought that.
But what you might get is that people who say get high and they on meth and then they become psychotic, that doesn't mean that psychosis is going to develop into schizophrenia. They have to keep doing meth in order to be psychotic. And if they were able to stay sober, they might not develop schizophrenia.
So I have a question on that one right there. So let's say someone is using, I feel like drug trends change in the country, but let's say someone's using meth or LSD or anything that you think about people that use a lot of substances to get psychotic, at least for me in law enforcement. So people that act really bizarre because of drugs. So that's really like meth, crack, LSD. If you use this for a continuous period of time, does that or can that cause you to develop schizophrenia?
Now, I don't exactly know the answer to that. Is it being caused by schizophrenia? I mean, are people who are predisposed to schizophrenia more likely to use substances? Yeah, I think so. And okay. the literature seems to support that people with schizophrenia use more substances.
Right.
So it does become a little chicken and eggy, you know.
Right.
Right. And so I don't know the answer. And if there's researchers out there that are listening and they do know the answer, please let us know. But as of now, I don't think that is a known thing.
Can that continuous drug use, though?
It's not doing your doing good.
I mean, can it cause, I guess, psychiatric problems? Like, see, let's say you've been using for 10 years and you stop.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, will you still have some of the same things you'd see?
The most classic problem that it causes sort of psychologically, which is the same as brain, is stunting. So if you start using alcohol at age 15 and you become an alcoholic and you've been an alcoholic for 15 years, you're now 30.
Right.
But you're kind of got the maturity of a 15-year-old. And that's one of the sort of working things that a lot of therapists, they just keep track of that. Like, okay, this guy's stunted. He's got to regrow.
And from you regrow from that?
I think so, yeah.
You could stop using your substances that you started when you're 14 or 15,
mm-hmm.
and then you're 30.
Yeah.
Which is already, you're kind of
this
setting
is
your way.
Maturity, right. Yeah.
And you can start growing from that. It's interesting.
I believe so. I mean, you're starting to get into the belief range, but yeah, absolutely. Right. The brain is very plastic, meaning it
My brain
changes.
Is not plastic. It's gooey and it sloshes around.
Nasty. No, plastic in the sense that it can change and adapt. When I was a kid, we were told, you do a drug, you kill a brain cell, it's gone forever, and you're running out of it.
Yeah, it's a fried egg. This is your brain.
Yeah, and there's no turning back. It's
scary.
Just not true anymore.
Right.
Brains adapt, they improvise, they make new pathways, they do all sorts of very cool things.
So what you're
things.
Suggesting is people should use more drugs?
That's what I'm trying
it's
to
safer.
Say. Man.
That's really, is that your code of ethics as a doctor right there? It's really nice.
Use all the drugs you can. No, that's absolutely not what I'm saying.
If you see a pill on the ground, just try it.
I'm saying that people with schizophrenia and major mental illnesses do drugs and alcohol more frequently than the average population. Why is that? We don't know.
Right.
Is there some kind of connection? Probably. Do people who use marijuana more likely to have schizophrenia? Yes. Is there something specific about marijuana, or is it people with schizophrenia are attracted to marijuana? Who knows? But it seems like since marijuana had a 50% conversion.
Right. That
seems
huge.
High. Yeah, that seems really high. Yeah.
But you don't.
It was just under 50%.
Right. Just under 49.99.
It was like 46 or something.
I think you should say 46.
I should get the article and make sure.
So, but you're not saying in order to be diagnosed with schizophrenia or develop that disease, you have to do drugs. You can develop the disease with not ever touching.
Oh, absolutely.
A drug.
Yeah, of course.
And it's kind of what's the age range typically where someone might develop that illness?
Schizophrenia?
Yeah.
So with men, it's younger. It's like in their late teens. And with women, it's a little older, in their 20s and 30s.
So, I mean,
and that's one of the reasons women do better. Is because...
What do you mean? Like, do better on that with that illness?
Yes. So
really? I didn't know that there was a...
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that? Okay.
No.
So it's interesting. So if you're... Think about it. If you're diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 7, just in general with the major mental illnesses, the younger you get them, the worse off you are, which makes sense, right? But if you are a man and you're, you know, just finished high school and you have a girlfriend and you're doing pretty well and maybe you're going to work or go to college and then you start to become paranoid and everything goes to S, we're allowed to curse.
Sure.
Everything goes to shit.
Oh, my goodness.
And your girlfriend leaves you. You've either drop out of school or can't hold your job.
Right.
You have to move in back with your parents if they can take you. You sort of have nothing.
Okay.
But if you get the disease older, you've already been married, you have kids, you have a stronger social network, and then you become schizophrenic, you have all those things in place. And so that's one of the reasons people with schizophrenia who develop it later in life do better.
Interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense when you
and
think about
just
that.
And it drives home the point of schizophrenia is a family problem. I mean, it's whatever that family may be. It could be your community. It could be your immediate family. But it's really those social networks that make any illness better. Yeah. No matter what that illness is, whether it's mental illness or physical illness, the more you have people around you who love and care for you, the better off you're going to do. And it's actually one of the the best predictors of outcomes is how many people are involved with this person and want them to do well and love them. That's a really good predictor in outcomes for schizophrenia.
Makes sense. How do you encourage a family or friends to be more?
How I do it is I let them know. Just what I told you.
Right.
You know, because families are always fixated on, not always, often fixated on get them medicine.
Right.
Because for many reasons, they want the miracle cure.
Right.
That's what they're hoping for, which I can't blame them. And also, they think that that's the way to go. They minimize the power that they have in this environment. And so I just remind them that you guys are if they're doing the right thing, I'm saying whatever small things that they're doing right, I said, look at all these things you are doing right. And a lot of families don't do that. And that has as big an impact on outcomes as medicine.
Right. Now, I mean, this is very just subjective, but when you were given the ages, I feel like the ages for males is also what I see in law enforcement, where people start using substances as men or guys.
Yeah,
males.
Probably.
And yeah. You would see it with, like, you didn't necessarily see younger females using a lot of different substances, but maybe when they get older, that's when you started running into using meth and things like that. Do you think is there any studies about how the age range when people start using drugs or experimenting?
Oh, yeah, of course, there's tons of that.
Is it typically older for women and younger for men?
You know, I'd have to look at that. I don't know.
I just didn't know if there's any relation to that, too.
If I had to guess, I would say yes. That's something we can obviously look up. I just don't know off the top of my head. But I think also when you look at the genders and law enforcement contact, it's the same thing. Men are more violent.
I guess so.
Men are more, they're probably
people are more likely to call
excessive.
On a guy acting strange than just a lone woman acting strange.
If there's a girl and a guy drunk at a bar, it's the guy who's going to get in a fist fight. The girl it's just less likely.
Yes, you know? That's very true.
So drugs make people do stupid things, but it just adds to what the stupidness you already are. You
right.
Know?
So you're saying as a doctor, men are more stupid. We're more stupid and prone to doing stupid things. That's very
true.
You
don't agree with that?
No, I do. Now, you know what also comes up, and I've heard this before, and then there was a recent case, and I'm like, it's kind of true, is people have asked, you know, that substance use is associated with a lot of major mental illnesses.
Yes.
And so they've asked, like, do you just become ill and then all of a sudden crave drugs? And if you didn't use substances before, how would you even know how to get them? And recently there was a case here about a gentleman that we were trying to help for a long time, has a major mental illness. I believe he's living with schizophrenia. And all of a sudden he started using drugs. But he didn't move to a lower income area or a more drug infested area. He's in the same area. So is there any studies about people with an illness? Do they seek out narcotics, or is this just?
I don't know of any specific studies, but I know of a lot of theoretical thinking behind it. And the most obvious is the self-medication hypothesis. You know, so if you have somebody who can't sleep, and they're up all night hearing voices, and they don't want to take psychiatric medicines, they might hear from a buddy or somebody about, oh, marijuana helps.
Right.
And then that's a big incentive. Or a friend that they meet might say, hey, you know, marijuana can help with this.
Right.
And so it's sort of when they otherwise wouldn't have done that.
They think
of it as a medicine to help them.
Right.
And I think that's a major way.
But I get that. But right now, marijuana in media and culture is being pushed as like a miracle medicine.
Yeah, sure.
So that might be understandable.
Yeah.
But no one's saying methamphetamine is a miracle medicine.
But I wouldn't be surprised if, and I'm certain it does happen, you know, I sleep all the time. I have no energy. Oh, dude, try this.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so that's where it happens. Or they hear about it. And also, I think there's that loss. You've lost so much.
Right.
So it's not like, okay, I'm schizophrenic, but everything's otherwise normal. It's not like, oh, I have high blood pressure.
Right.
You know, it's my life is a big shambles. And so there's that, there's a kind of a giving up or a surrendering. And also, people with schizophrenia often, or very often, are flattened. They're just kind of, nothing excites them. And so maybe they need that. Maybe they want that kind of excitement. And there are also more theories. I mean, they're targets. Someone with schizophrenia is a target. Oh, you get a monthly check now? Let me come by your house. Why don't you buy this?
It'll help you focus.
And people with schizophrenia have a hard time saying no.
Right. And especially if you've already burned bridges
because
of it, which unfortunately it seems like a lot of people who are living with schizophrenia, like you said, they don't have the support of – and it seems like us as humans, we want to connect with other humans, and if that way is to, you know, you try to fit in.
No, but I think what we have to remind our audience, which there's a lot of people in law enforcement, is that people with schizophrenia often do quite well.
Right.
You know, we just see the ones that are just doing horribly, horribly, and using meth and doing all this stuff and can't stay housed and live on the street. But a lot of them with good families, those aren't the ones we see, with some exceptions. We see, but often they don't have good families. And these good families take care of their kids and they bring them to the doctor and they structure their lives for them and they get them in programs and they just kind of muddle through their day and maybe they're happy as anybody else.
Right, because it's like 1.something% of the population
is
living with schizophrenia. Yeah. And us in law enforcement probably see about 1% of that population.
Yeah. And all the time. Yeah.
But we see the same people and unfortunately, like you're saying, we don't see just the illness. We typically see the illness plus substances.
Yes.
Which makes it even more, you know, criminal related.
Yeah.
And more bizarre typically.
Yes.
And so it's easy to develop stigmas and biases towards
that. Oh, absolutely. It's sort of human nature. How would you not develop stigma and bias? That's why you have to make a very strong effort to not.
Yeah, that's so strange. So if you were to try to summarize it.
Okay.
The chicken or the egg, what comes first, you think? Do you think it's
what comes first in terms of
schizophrenia or substance use? Do you think it's the substance use is causing it majority, or is it that the illness is there?
Oh, I think the illness is probably the primary thing. I think there is a certain percentage of people who are going to get schizophrenia no matter what they do for themselves. Eat right, exercise, never touch a drug. And so that's really unfortunate. I think that's a pretty big chunk of all people with schizophrenia. And then maybe there's a smaller chunk that, you know, oh, they got schizophrenia because your mother in utero had an infection or they were, you know, abused or whatever. They did drugs. Who knows? And you're not sure if it's – would they have gotten schizophrenia otherwise? You just don't know.
Right.
And then there's probably – but I'm certain it's there. There is a small percentage of people with schizophrenia who would not have gotten it had they not done drugs. That's just a certainty.
It's such a horrible illness. Yeah. I remember there was a guy that we were working, and we had to call his mom. We didn't see any sign of substance use and say, like, hey, you know, he had to go to the hospital. Uh-huh. Looks like he has schizophrenia. And the mom's like, nope, it's drugs. It's no, it's this. They're like, no, he's using drugs. We need to find rehab. And I was like, wow, like, it's more acceptable in that family to think your child is a substance user than...
Yeah.
Your child has schizophrenia. It's scary.
God, if I had a choice for my kids, I'd probably want that too. Because there's substance abuse is devastating and horrible, and the high mortality rate that it has. Theoretically, it's curable.
I guess
schizophrenia, you're right, as of today, is not really curable. It's manageable. And there's some outlier cases where people get cured, but were they really schizophrenic in the first place?
Right.
But it's not curable. It's like homelessness. You know, we had this big discussion about homelessness and should you have a shelter that focuses a lot on mental health, because there's a big crossover. About a third people with homelessness have mental health issues, I mean, which is not that much higher just than the whole population. Or should you have a center that's really focused on behavioral health? And, you know, a little bit of homelessness, if you come in and you're homeless, we won't turn you away and we'll try to guide you. I think they should be separated. But some people think they should sort of be one big monolithic, we serve everybody. And I was wondering what you thought about that, because I obviously have an opinion and it's based on stuff, but I'm curious about what you think.
So
if you're an administrator, if you're the mayor,
right,
and he presents you two plans, and the first group comes up and says, I think we need one big center where we can really focus on ending homelessness and have a shelter, and anybody with a major mental illness or any kind of behavioral health need can come there 24/7 and get care. Police can bring people, whether they're using substances, homelessness. They don't have to decide what. They just drop them off. They turn away, right, which would be great.
Okay.
That's proposal one. Proposal two is we should have a homeless shelter that focuses on getting people housing and getting them transitional housing. And if someone comes in who's homeless and doesn't have any history of mental illness, we'll help them. That's our primary target. But if they also have a serious mental illness, we can handle that.
Right.
And we're not going to ignore it, or we might transfer them, but we can handle it. And then have a separate one that's focused on behavioral health, a separate sort of triage center, like a whole package behavioral health center.
Right.
They can be close to each other, they can be far from each other, but they're two separate things. Now, you're the mayor. Which one do you want?
But the second option, you get both centers, right?
The option one is one giant center.
The other one
is twice as big as the two separate, let's just
but
say.
But the second option is you have a specialty one for homelessness and one for just behavioral health.
Yeah.
The second option would be the best.
Yeah, that's what I think, too.
Well, it seems obvious. People are going
to
do...
seems obvious to us, but
people
not
are going to
gonna
do better with a specialty approach. If I was experiencing
but then why not subspecialize it even more? Schizophrenia, bipolar clinic, and that's the route we've gone.
I mean, if you
gone.
Had that option and truly...
I don't know. I disagree with that. See, now
I mean, it depends on what your objectives are. If there is like a if you're talking about like a crisis drop-off center that at 24 hours that anyone can go to and law enforcement, I think that's different. That's a crisis.
Yeah.
What you're looking at is crisis. If you're trying to get people out of homelessness and particularly a homeless crisis... it's a different type of crisis than behavioral health. And I think a specialty center would help someone in that.
Yeah, I agree.
On that.
I agree.
And because I hate to say it, but there's a people look at homeless people as being criminals, dirty, things like that. And if you were not homeless, but you needed help in something, you may not want to go to some place where you're like, well, the homeless are there. I'm not like that.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. There's just a lot of stigma around
it. And I think it works both ways. Some of the homeless people are like, I'm not going to go to a behavioral health place.
Right.
I'm not going to hang out with those crazies.
I'm just
so I think that's another big reason.
Yeah.
And I think the other reason is going back to why this conversation started is homeless is curable.
Right.
You go in, and if you have enough will and enough money, give somebody a house, and if they want a house, cure.
Right.
You can't do that with mental illness. It's a different thing. You don't, you know, a lot of people who are unemployed have mental health issues.
Right.
But you don't say, let's have an unemployment behavioral health center.
It's
like,
true.
No. Yeah. If someone's unemployed, we'll try to help them.
Right.
We're not going to turn them away, but this is a behavioral health center.
Right.
So that's going back. So back to schizophrenia. That's, I think it's a different thing. It's not substance abuse in theory is curable.
Makes sense.
Curable is not the right word. You may always be an alcoholic, and you always have to avoid alcohol, but it's essentially your recovery, you're
more functional.
Yeah, you're recovered.
Yeah, because you could be in recovery and live with schizophrenia, but
it's
you may not be able to hold a job.
Yeah,
still.
It's a different type of recovery. Expectations are different.
No, that
outcomes
makes sense.
Are different, yeah.
So you don't think, though, on the center idea, that having specialty locations, maybe I'm not thinking of drop-off centers, I'm just thinking of specialty programs, is better than just having a general overview?
I think it would be better to have the specialist available and rotate through there. And it's ideally you want both. Someone comes to the main center, they establish a relationship with the provider or a doctor or whomever. They diagnose them with bipolar. They got them started on meds. And then after a couple of months, they transfer. That's how I would envision it. So if you have specialists, you transfer them to the specialist. Or if they don't need a specialist, a lot of people with serious mental illness can be managed by their primary care doctor. Send them there. So I think specialists are great to have. But I think medicine and this entire – all of America, I think, has become too subspecialized. You have specialists within specialists. I mean, you can't just –
I feel like that's in every profession now.
Yeah.
Too.
Oh, absolutely. And the trend in the last probably – 15 years is to sort of reintegrate people, you know, have
economists
meet
with
lawyers and whatnot. But
what did you just say? Have the communists meet with lawyers?
No, economists.
Oh, I was like, what are you
like
talking
economists
about?
Meet with psychologists
and meet with architects
and all discuss how to build a building and a center.
Right.
Where before it was just the architects, and then it became the architects who only do behavioral health and the architects who only do behavioral health with this or that.
Right.
And I think it's better to sort of collaborate.
Yeah. It's interesting.
But then again, if I had some kind of disease, I'd want the specialist. Right. You know?
So. It's just it's good marketing.
Yeah.
You feel like you're getting better treatment. You may not be.
Yeah.
But just because that person is a, quote, specialist.
And there's also so much more information.
So, I mean, I know you are much more familiar with medicine when you're talking about specialists. Do you feel like law enforcement is becoming too specialized? Because I'm hearing that a lot from officers. Like, well, some departments are too specialized.
I don't have a strong opinion on it either way. But I could see that, yeah, you can make an argument for both. I think people get too subspecialized, and then they say, oh, well, that's not my job. Then they start to shy away from a lot of stuff.
But you as a citizen.
And it's the same with medicine. Oh, I can't handle that. I'm not a cardiac specialist.
Right.
Yeah.
But you as a citizen.
Okay.
If you think, like, what do I want in my police department? Do you want it to be specialized? Or do you want it to be like, oh, I just want an officer to handle everything?
No, I think you have to specialize it. I mean, if there's a homicide, you want somebody who knows how to handle homicides.
Right.
If there's a mental health issue, ideally you want somebody who has some mental health training. It's really hard because you have to have generalists and you have to have specialists, and you can't get around that. It's just, where do you draw the line? Where do you make the balance?
Right.
And some departments are probably out of whack. And is ours? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is.
It's interesting because people will argue, typically they come from larger departments, you know, mid to large departments, so it's too specialized.
Yeah.
You know, well, I heard this department, they handle everything. And, you know, I'll be like, well, yeah, but that's a department of 10 people. They don't have the choice to be specialized, you know. And if you go to, like, rural medicine and you're
same
going
deal.
For stuff, like, you just – you don't have that option.
That's why you have Echo, Matt.
Yeah, well, I mean, Echo's a great project.
Echo is
that.
A great project.
So, yeah, because you can kind of reach out and pick people's brains and get more education.
Yeah.
It was interesting when we learned about it for medicine. I mean, it was so foreign to me in law enforcement, but I was like, this, you know,
Well, what do you think? Do you think we're too specialized, or one department can be too specialized?
You know, I personally don't think that one. I mean, I think it's organizations are developed and hopefully around community and what's best for that community.
Yeah.
So if a community, you know, if you get better police response because field officers are available because you are able to shift a call to a specialist, you should do it.
Okay.
You know, it depends if that's what the community needs. If that's a community wants, you know, doesn't care about response time and it's just like, I want one officer that's my go-to that handles my case from start to finish.
Sure.
But most places aren't like that. I don't know of single ones, you know, but it just depends on what you want.
No, but if you're comparing the medical model and the law enforcement model, if it would kind of be nice if the first officer who came out was your point person.
Right.
And kind of like what we do.
Yeah.
But we are not primary responders. But if you go to your primary care doctor, you might see this special and that specialist, but they're your home base. And
right.
Medical homes are a new, really cool model, too.
Medical homes?
Medical home is like...
I'm thinking of, like, retirement.
No,
like,
no.
Yeah, when
medical
you say
home
that.
Is more of a virtual home. I mean, it's also a building, but it's more like, okay, this is where I get all my care. I go to this one place, and there's a primary care doctor, and maybe there's a diabetes specialist, and maybe there's a psychiatrist, and they all coordinate. And if they need to send me to an outside specialist, either that specialist rotates in once in a while, or they send me to that person. They coordinate it, but I know where my people are.
That actually is the same with law enforcement, though.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you were like your primary care is your uniformed patrol officer.
Yeah.
They should be handle the majority, if not all, of your needs for service.
Yeah.
And if it reaches a certain point where it requires more time or specialist response, they can make the referral. They make the referral for follow up. At a specialty, and then how you're saying about the different
specialists. No, but I think the primary officer doesn't, they don't manage the case. They're not.
The majority of cases they do.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah. The majority of field officer will go out, they take the initial investigation, and they make the determination if it's criminal or not.
No, but I guess once
they
pass it on
but
to
I'm
a
saying,
specialist, it's a one-way
right,
ticket.
That's true.
That's what's different in medicine. Mm-hmm. If you pass it on to a specialist, it always comes back to you, or should
to
always
your,
come
to
you.
To your primary?
If I'm the primary care
I haven't
doctor,
noticed that.
It should always come back to me. You know,
whenever I've had to go to a specialist, it's like my specialist is now what handles that section of me.
Really?
Yeah.
And then you have a permanent specialist?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's how it has always been. I don't know.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, then, no, that's a different model.
Would the model be? You go to a specialist, and then you go back and tell your primary care, this is what I need?
The two doctors talk to each other.
That doesn't exist. Doctors don't talk to each other.
Like you go to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist gets you on the right meds, and maybe it takes 2 weeks, maybe right. it takes 10 months. But you're like, okay, you're on these. Go back.
But do you think that's just psychiatry?
No, I think that's all professions.
So let's say you go because you have kidney stones.
If you have a surgery, you don't fall. You're not followed by that surgeon indefinitely.
No, but the surgery is a one-time thing. It's a surgery. Let's say it's a chronic thing, like a specialist for diabetes or kidney stones or something like that.
Yeah,
I think that's ongoing.
But it should still be coordinated with the primary care doctor. So you see your specialist maybe once every 6 months. Or once every other year, or however much it takes, you should be seeing your primary care doctor more frequently. You should be managing all of it, including that one ailment.
I guess that would be one discipline.
Well, they're very. We can't compare law enforcement and medicine indefinitely.
But what you bring up is an interesting point that I do think is a huge disconnect internally in law enforcement.
Okay,
when you are a field officer and you feel like this should have a specialized response or investigation, you forward it to that unit, you rarely hear back from that unit.
Yeah, that's
and I
not
think
great.
That is a disconnect because I think it reduces morale. I think officers feel like I'm just doing this and these other people, they don't care.
Yeah,
and it's simple as just a follow like, hey,
way.
I got that. I'm going to be looking into it. And then, you know, if it is like a criminal investigation, hey, I looked into it. I made an arrest. Thanks for your work. Anything that's simple.
Yeah, yeah.
And that can be done by email. That doesn't take more than 2 minutes, but we just don't do it.
Yeah,
and I think, but I don't know how you would encourage that kind of change.
I don't know. I mean, I think when field officers do get that feedback, they always like it.
Yeah,
and if you did it consistently, you know, the field officers are going to become the detectives one day, and then they have more of an incentive to do that. Yeah, I mean, the field officers, they make a referral. They want to know what happened.
Right.
Yeah, just getting a thank you is always great. Mm-hmm. And going back to medicine, that was one of the things we always had to do. Thank you for the consult. You know, even though you're like, why? Why are you consulting me is what you're thinking.
Right.
And you're like, thank you so much for the consult of this very interesting case.
Right.
But yeah, one, you should thank them for the consult, and then you should tell them the outcome.
Yeah.
Well, we did this and we did that, and it didn't work. I mean, or next time, why don't you try this or that when you see them? Yeah, I agree 100%.
It would be interesting.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
But I think those little, like that program we're going to try to get, the ride-along, the app, will solve a lot of that stuff.
Hopefully.
Because you'll make a referral to CIT or CIU, whatever, and
you should be able to follow it through.
Yeah, you can just check for yourself if you want. Yeah.
No, that's a great point.
Yeah,
I think in theory, people can check now, at least for our type of cases.
But it's more cumbersome.
Right.
You know, I mean, this will be easy.
It'd be interesting. Yeah. I hope if we do get that we actually do some research on it, like do some officer, you know, interviews or surveys. And
that's a good idea. Yeah, and I think that is the plan. They're going to do a pilot, maybe in the Valley or something, and then go from there.
Yeah, I'm curious if anyone listening here is in law enforcement, and you guys maintain any kind of online system that gives you guys knowledge of. One, I guess if you guys have to have a mental health or behavioral health unit, but information on individuals that may come in contact. So it'll give you like hooks and triggers. So things that people like to talk about, maybe emergency contacts for them, doctor phone number, something that should give you enough to help out on any kind of crisis call so that you don't feel overwhelmed. You know, you're going to this person, you should talk about this or not talk about certain things. But if you have access to that, you know, I think this is a newer thing. Our department does this, and I think Seattle and maybe a few other, but I don't know if this is catching on.
Yeah.
And I've heard arguments both sides, but it'd be interesting. If you guys are listening and you do this, let us know.
Yeah.
Is it something that you guys do? And one, do you actually look through if you make a forward? Like, do you look through and like, let me check on John Doe. Uh-huh. Did he make it in here and what's happening?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious on that.
Good.
And like the other stuff too. Like if you guys have a question, like Steve's, you guys can send it to ask@gocit.org. And then since Doc says he's back,
I'm ready to answer all your questions.
Yeah. If you guys have any questions,
And then next time I'll read the question in advance and be even more. I'll have the article with me.
I'll sound a lot smarter. We're doing a podcast. But, you know, send it again at ask@gocit.org. Anything law enforcement, behavioral health related, we'll answer it. If you guys are enjoying these podcasts, you know, check it out on iTunes. Don't forget to rate us. As long as it's 5 stars. If not, tell me why and I'll fix it. And like Doc mentioned before, we're going to do Project Echo. We're actually going to have a session coming up on this one. And what you guys will be listening to is one of the lectures or didactics from the CIT Echo. You guys can check out more about it at gocit.org. It is open and free training. We do case management on that and case staffings, anything behavioral health related. And it's open to public safety or anyone that's involved in a CIT program. If you guys are looking for more information on that, you guys can hit up the project coordinator, that's Jen Earhart, at J-E-A-R-H-E-A-R-T at CABQ.gov. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for your questions. Bye.
Goodbye.
All right. I'm starting. Is that what's happening? Okay. So this is a class that Matt and I have given many times to many different kinds of groups. It's about negotiations and communication with difficult people. And we give a version, almost a very similar version, to the medical students. And it's like an hour and a half course. So we're probably just going to go through some of the beginning.
And I'll say that this is kind of if any of you guys have taken a negotiations course, you're going to see some common trends, and you're also going to see some common trends with CIT stuff. It's just an easier way for us to put kind of a basic negotiations into hopefully an easy to remember format.
So we use an acronym, because everybody uses acronyms, and ours is the one we're using today is PURE. So it's pause, unite, refocus, and educate. And Matt and I will give you just an overview of what those different sort of phases of the negotiation are. And then we're probably going to focus mostly just on pause today. We'll pause for pause. Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Topper?
No. There's a little turtle.
Thank you.
Neil likes to put animals I love.
You always talk about the turtle. Tell us about the turtle.
So what, honestly, from the network, when you guys see a picture of this, like this tortoise or this turtle upside down, what do you guys think?
Turtle stew. Turtle stew. Sociopath.
Sociopath Adrian needs to go to the hospital. What would be an emotion, maybe, that you would attach to this?
Helpless.
Helpless is a good one. Maybe we'll chat on that one. See, helpless, stuck.
Relatable.
Relatable.
Relatable. Need help to write themselves. That's a good one. What if it was a picture of just some guy on his back on the street? Honestly.
Intoxicated.
Intoxicated. What would be another word that you guys would use for that one? Drunk. Lazy. What's that? Oh, down and out.
Down and out.
It's like D.O. It's like, what? Yeah, I mean, these are all terms we use, and I think it's just a natural bias that we develop. For some reason, we, you know, often look at animals as being innocent, that they don't have control over this, so we're easier to find a positive emotion, that they're helpless or that they're injured. But often when we get to stuff and it's a person, we think the negative. We jump to that person's drunk, that person's out of it, that person did this to themselves, they chose to use drugs, they chose to be mentally ill, they chose to be this way. And that's a natural bias we bring in. And so sometimes that's the first thing we need to just get it around to ourselves, is that we have our own biases. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but as long as you're aware of it, you can successfully communicate with somebody. If you realize that you're putting blame on that person, you'll never have a successful negotiation or building rapport with them to influence decisions. So it's a good point to remember. And everyone loves animals for some reason. So that's a good tip, ask people about animals. They'll typically like it.
Absolutely. It's just not wanting to do it. Okay. So here's just an overview. I don't know if you guys can read it, but we'll go through these quickly. So pausing really is about not rushing, obviously. It's about pausing. So you want to gather collateral information, know what you're getting yourself into. Always focus on safety. And these are things that you guys obviously know very well. Safety is the basically the cornerstone of your whole profession. But sometimes collateral might be overlooked. A neighbor who can be talked to about a suicidal neighbor can be very helpful, or a spouse. These things can be very, very helpful. And always know your fail-safe plan. So that's, if everything goes wrong, what can you do? So these are very important, especially for people, you know, medical students and other people. The one that's probably the most important, and we'll talk about the most today, is staying aware of your own emotions. because it's really the it's your emotions that make things go awry in communications and negotiations. You have very little. We talk so much about de-escalating that other person and calming them down, but really you got to calm yourself down. You got to be aware of what you're going through before you even can think about calming someone else down. So we'll talk more about that. And then I'll go through these next ones just as a preview. So uniting is getting on the same page as somebody, defining shared goals and problems and working towards those together. Refocusing is continuing to stay focused on things that are productive instead of, rambling off into something that's not helpful and refocusing back onto shared goals and problems. And educating is, looking for solutions as opposed to giving orders. This whole model is borrowed from somewhat from CNT, from, I don't know if people out there know of motivational interviewing and negotiation tactics, for buying a car, selling a car. So these are all just sort of it's just a package to help remember them, the pure. Do you want to say anything?
No. I'm in trouble with this. No. This ruined everything.
Pause. Okay. So we're going to spend some time on this slide, and hopefully we can have a discussion. If not, it'll be a discussion between Matt and me, which I'm okay with. So pausing, really, one of the most fundamental things about pausing is kind of remembering why you're there in the first place. I'm talking big picture stuff. Why are you in this job? Why are you here? You got to remind yourself of these things, or otherwise you can burn out. All the cops that I know are there because they have compassionate goals. They want to help people. They want to help the community. And it's very easy to lose sight of that when you're seeing your fifth down and out in the day. It's not a cute, cuddly, animal on the side of the road that instantly brings up a lot of empathy. So it's very important to remember empathy and compassion. So I'm going to turn to Matt and ask him for a working definition of empathy.
Well, this is where you and I have arguments sometimes.
Okay, you want me to give my definition then?
I think, I think I'm a big fan of promoting and teaching an empathetic or empathy response. And mainly what I look at that is more of us translating that we truly are empathetic towards the people we're helping. A lot of times we get in the habit of just the facts, or we're trying to get whatever the bare minimum to get that report and move on, just because calls are stacking and we have the pressure to clear calls. And some of these minor calls, I shouldn't say minor calls, but some of the calls that we might seem as minor, like a down and out, we want to just be done with it so that we can move on to trying to stop, major crimes from happening, major violence, things like that. And so we often overlook the person as a person and more of it as a call. This is a call, it's not a human, and we lose that empathetic response. But also there's downsides to empathy.
Well, first, anybody in video land or in here want to give a definition for empathy, and then I'll give mine. Somebody?
Jen, I hate to ask you, but I think you're going to have to monitor the chat.
Oh, because people type in their answers.
Well, I'll say.
Okay.
This is Karen. Empathy is trying to relate to what that person is feeling and not putting your own views on it. Kind of if that were you.
Okay. Putting yourself in their shoes.
Yeah.
So that, I agree. Empathy is an emotion, and it has many definitions. The definition I use is sort of the most common one, sort of putting yourself in someone else's shoes and feeling and understanding what they're going through. So empathy is generally, it has two components. There's an automatic component. You see a turtle on the side of the road turned upside down and you think, oh gosh, and you feel that urge, that automatic response. Or a better example is someone gets injured. You're watching a basketball game and the player gets injured really badly and their knee tweaks and you feel it. You literally go, oh, and you cringe. That's sort of that automatic empathy, which we all possess as human beings. Someone smiles and starts laughing. Everybody in the room is laughing and you start laughing, even if you don't get the joke. So that's empathy. It's an automatic emotion that just comes out of nowhere. empathy also has a cognitive component. So I understand what you're going through. I understand, I can think and guess what you're thinking and feeling without that emotional state. So downsides to empathy. So there are many potential downsides to empathy. And a lot of CIT training and medical training, for that matter, focuses a lot on empathy as an unconditional good. And it really isn't. It's an emotion, sort of like anger. People often think of anger as an unconditionally bad thing, but it really isn't, because anger is what motivates people to make changes, to you know, petition the government or to rally or do something, to make changes in their lives. So without anger, there'd be a lot more apathy and complacency. And empathy can be the same way. It can motivate people to do good things, but it can also be a motivator for things that are not necessarily so good. Can you think of some?
I've talked about the downsides?
Downsides to empathy.
What did you guys, I'm curious on from the network. What did you guys?
Chris Carvajal, Rio Rancho Police.
Okay, great.
Go, Chris.
I would say a downside to empathy is possibly vicarious trauma or secondary stress.
It's like we paid you to say that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That you couldn't have it more on the money. That is one of the biggest downsides to empathy. It's not the only one, but that's a big one, because it causes burnout. It causes vicarious trauma too in other. You're feeling the pain of all these people who are suffering constantly, and you take it home, and it makes it really hard, and you can be traumatized.
Yeah. Any other downsides that you guys are seeing or can think of?
Maybe, this is Adrian Garcia. Maybe you kind of lose some officer safety or anybody's safety when you have empathy for somebody. I think you kind of want to help them, and sometimes you forget that it's still a safety issue.
I think that's a very neat point. So if you guys, and I apologize, I'm just not sure how well the mic's picking up on this, but Adrian said about it could cause maybe some issues with officer safety on it. Is that maybe you become so empathetic that you're not seeing the danger cues in somebody. Maybe you're just trying to connect with them on an emotional level, and you overlook some of that stuff, which makes sense. It's just human nature. I mean, if you're talking to your buddy, you're not going to think, is my buddy dangerous? You know, you're trying to figure out what's going on with them, and you're looking at their emotional level. It's a good one. Anyone else that you guys can think of? Any other downsides?
Nope. You guys are doing better than the medical students, just so you know.
Yeah, Dorian Dixon, APD.
Good, Dorian.
One downside that I can kind of see when you empathize with the victim of a crime, it can unintentionally create biases towards different suspects and different people. Yeah, when you start empathizing, like there's a person that I've worked with a couple times who's the victim of regular 20s burglaries, and you know, he feeds off a lot. He's a very emotional person, and if you give into that too much, it's definitely possible to look at a suspect and have a bias, because he, like I said, he gives off that angry emotion.
You guys are the best group. I mean, and that's the one most people overlook. Empathy, and studies bear this out, not only are you smart for picking up on that, but it is, it's biased. Empathy is biased. People are inherently empathetic to people that look like them, that are of a high socioeconomic class, that are good looking. Those people get more empathy than just the drunk on the side of the street. It's just automatic. You just automatically have more empathy for them. So it's biased. It can lead to some serious biases and prejudice, for that matter. So you're exactly right. It can bias your judgment, and that is a big problem in the whole legal system, biases. So nice.
Can I say something?
Those are great ones, yeah.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't say this because it'll make me sound really awful, but I didn't even think of that, what you said about good looking people.
Okay. Because I look at you and
I'm
like,
I hate you guys. And I wanted to tell.
So you guys posted on the CIT site an article about an 18-year-old girl with schizophrenia the other day, mm-hmm. who draws pictures and stuff, and I looked at her pictures and they're amazing. But what really impressed me about her, this is going to come out so bad, she captions them too, and it was, you know, while she still has insight, she just fascinated me. But I was looking through her stuff, And there's pictures of her as well. And I thought, oh, she's so pretty. Why did I think that?
Yeah.
What would I not have been impressed or thought that if she wasn't? And so when you just said that now, I thought, wow, even me. Even
you. But you know, it's a good point that you brought up, especially with schizophrenia. A lot of the people we see in law enforcement that are living with schizophrenia and they're not taking care of it or the not, you know, in treatment or recovery, they're typically not well kept. You know, a lot of them are living on the streets. They have really messy houses or apartments. They're saying odd things. They're not bathed. It's easy to not have, it's harder, I think personally, to develop empathy for someone like that than it would be for like that girl who was in recovery, was clean, you know, was trying to do stuff, was in a news article. Much different life. And we naturally do this and we're not aware of it. But it's also one of those things. Is it something that you should bring up often in training? Do you think this is something that goes unlooked?
Overlooked? meaning empathy?
Like this kind of things, like these biases that we see.
I think it's worth mentioning because I didn't even realize that one. And we talk about those biases a lot, but I didn't even realize that one.
Yeah, and I think this is where it gets very difficult when you are on a higher risk call. Let's say someone's in a behavioral health crisis. Let's say they're just a danger themselves, but they're locked into a public bathroom with like a shard of glass to their neck. Mm-hmm. And they have a long beard. They look possibly homeless. It's a lot harder to build empathy on that than the 16-year-old daughter that just had a breakup and wants to kill themselves. Yeah. It's a lot easier. We feel more buy-in to like, we got to save this 16-year-old. They're both human beings. And who's to determine whose life is worth more? But we have to be aware of that. You have to kind of go, okay, how do I build empathy? How do I make sure that my communication isn't biased on one end? And you see the difference because sometimes you go and you'll see in that example, someone will start with rapport building with the younger female. But with the other person, they'll start giving commands. Get out of the bathroom. This is a lawful order. And we resort back to it. But sometimes it's still the same thing. We still need to build rapport to influence people's decisions. But we have to be aware that sometimes it is that bias.
No, the whole point of the pause is to pause and look at yourself and take stock of yourself and think, okay, this is a good-looking person or this is a homely person. You know, no, but you're going to have an emotion.
Like, oh, yeah.
If you don't take a moment to... No, but it's true.
I'm going to take you in, baby.
But if you don't take that moment to think about it, you know, you're going to be pulled on by strings that you're not.
Right.
But if you take time and think about it, then you can have a fuller picture of what's going on. There are a couple more things that empathy can be problematic. And I'm not saying empathy is a bad thing, but there's a couple more ways. And if you guys get either of these, I'll be very impressed.
Denise from Coast. What about on the other end? If I've been there, I've done that, that's happened to me, but thinking I understand, and I really don't, because I'm really not in their shoes.
Yeah, sure.
So on the other side?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Right? That's a very good one. It could sort of automatic, and it'll make you do things it'll make you jump to conclusions
and
make assumptions. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I had a quick question. This is Dorian Dixon from APD. Listening to your discussion real quick about empathy, something that both Dr. Rosenbaum and Detective Tinney said, are we under the understanding that empathy is something that you feel like an emotion? I've always understood empathy to be an objective skill. It's something that I just use. I don't necessarily feel. I mean, yes, you can feel empathy, but regardless of what someone looks like, I can be empathetic towards someone without feeling anything for them.
So the way, that's a great, great question. And there's not a great scientific consensus on how to define empathy yet, but most people agree that it sort of has two parts, that automatic emotion that you and every other person on the planet feels. Like if you ever go to a movie and you identify with the characters and you get excited and you jump up in your seat, that's empathy. You're putting yourself in their shoes kind of automatically. And then there's the more cognitive empathy, which is what you're talking about. This is a skill. I'm making an effort to understand what that person's going through. And then there's the kind of what you're talking about and what Matt often talks about is the show of empathy, the display of empathy. And that's, you know, just one part of it. How do you show that? And that's what we'll talk a little bit about compassion too. because you can be, you can show that understanding without getting sucked into the automatic and the difficult parts of empathy.
So I'm actually curious, Dorian, on if you could define kind of, in your opinion, what compassion is versus empathy.
So I would define compassion as being, I want to use the word a sense of forgiveness for someone. It's when you're compassionate towards someone, you are forgiving of their situation. And that can be, I can show compassion to someone's suffering and pain. I'm not going to, when I'm compassionate, I'm willing to give more positive emotion to that. I'm willing to help them a little bit more, show compassion for their situation rather than judge them for their situation or display a negative emotion for their situation. And so compassion towards someone who is angry towards police or who's aggressive, again, it's being willing to forgive their situation and use more positive emotions and not display negative emotions. Where empathy, I've always understood empathy to be just the understanding of what someone feels. It's not necessarily that I'm positive or negative in regards to what they feel. I just actively understand it without, I guess, reflecting it or letting it necessarily affect my expression of emotion.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, no, that the part of the kind of empathy you're describing is the sort of cognitive empathy, the understanding, which is extremely important and can be what you're describing as dispassion or not emotional. Empathy is usually, it has a broader definition, but that doesn't mean that yours is wrong. There is no consensus of what's right and wrong, but there is. Whether that's whatever definition you use, there is an emotion of empathy that we need to be aware of. So even if there is and they interplay. So if you're not aware of that emotion, your cognitive understanding is going to change. So you see somebody that looks like you, that is young and attractive, you might think, oh, I really understand what they're going through. But that emotional empathy is sneaking in because it's just an emotion. We always have emotions. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does.
I think it's a good point, especially.
And I like your definition of compassion.
I think if you ever want to talk about this, especially if you're trying to come up with a game plan on communications or rapport building, and we use terms like empathy and compassion, I think we should all be on the same page on what we mean by that.
Yeah.
Because it could mean two different things to two different people. And so I think it goes a long way. And compassion is one thing that Neil's really likes to promote, especially in law enforcement and other helping professions to prevent burnout. I don't know if you want to.
So I'll go through the last two problems with empathy. One is it's sort of, there's a diminishing returns. It's illogical. So if one, there's studies that show, like, if there's a girl who falls down a well, people feel a lot of empathy for that little girl. They want to help her. They want to go out of their way. They want to do things. If two kids fall down the well, there's actually less empathy. And if there's 10 or 50, or there's 1,000 and they're hit by a tsunami and they're far away, actually empathy goes down. And if you put 10 kids in that well and you do empathy scales, the empathy goes down for all of the kids, including the first kid. So it's not a logical way to approach your caring profession. So if you're doing it, just it sort of leads you around by the nose. The last thing is that empathy is, people who are con men and antisocials and manipulators are very good at using your empathy against you and pressing your buttons. And they're also very good at using their empathy to understand what's important to you, what's not important to you, how to manipulate you. So if you're out in the field, a really good manipulator, you won't even notice you're getting manipulated.
And you see this in bullying too.
Yeah, and bullies are very good at empathy, which is weird. They're very good at picking up on the emotions and troubles of other people. Okay, so compassion. I really liked your definition of compassion in that it's forgiveness. It's sort of approaching somebody with an idea that you want to help them unbiasedly. That's kind of the definition I'm getting from you. And my definition is very similar. It's sort of taking an interest in the suffering of somebody else and wanting to do something about that suffering. And so I think forgiveness is a nice one to add into it. What's that? Are you going to do 44 slides? No, we're going to end soon. Okay.
Sorry, just watching the clock.
And so what makes compassion so important is that it doesn't lead to the same kind of burnout, the same kind of manipulation, the same kind of biases. And so if you're really there, it's compassionate to think, well, how are we going to help all 100 people that are injured as opposed to this one little kid that is in the fire and that's the only one I care about? Because that's empathy as opposed to compassion. You know, our whole city has trouble. So we have to look at it from a big compassionate standpoint. Do you have anything you want to add? I can keep.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I used to get in arguments with Niels about compassion and empathy, but it's just more about our definitions of it. And because I always, my thing is, I think if you get into law enforcement, you just naturally have that compassion already, because no one wants to do this job unless you actually want to help people. Chaplain Clancy mentioned a unique one. So he said, you know, in his line of work, working with law enforcement, that chaplains are awfully implemented for community relations. And that's the same on our end too. That's what our chaplains do. And so they're pretty much have a higher scale or required to have a higher scale of empathy and compassion. And so I could not agree more with that. And then they're talking, and he mentioned something about homeless experts as being manipulative with empathy and compassion, or I might have completely misread that. But do you guys feel that compassion can be taught? And if so, how? How do you teach compassion?
Dixon from APD again. I think it's something that has to be taught through, like when you have a child, you force them to, you put them in a situation where compassion is an appropriate response, and you explain it to them, and then you expose them to similar situations. And so it's through that exposure, as an adult, through the exposure of situations, and then say you don't respond appropriately, you're explained this, you should be responding with compassion. Through continuous exposure, I believe it can be taught.
So,
or at least, yeah.
So I agree with that.
So would you say maybe if we're looking in law enforcement, could that be scenario-based learning and maybe like OJT on the job training?
I would say yes. That's probably the best we can get.
No, I think that is a great way to show it. Instead of people starting to think, you know, we want to see people act on this stuff. What about any other ideas from the network on this one? Any other ways that compassion can be taught?
Chris Pepperhall, Real Rancho Police.
Yeah, go please.
So I think life experiences are important for compassion. So in terms of law enforcement, they only see people in mid-crises. I think having those people, and you guys do these panels where they're not in mid-crises, and you see how they are when they're in a healthier being, you can kind of have them explain why they diminish into crises, and then what helps them get out of it, and show that they are a person, not just a person in crisis.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah,
I think some, you know, and like you mentioned, that we only see the worst of everything, and that includes mental health or substance use or anything. We see the negatives in law enforcement, all of it. And it is nice to see someone in a better state, and then we can understand why it is that we should take someone to the hospital, or we should care about their threats of suicide or their odd statements. And I think it does help with compassion. I agree with you.
And then we'll wrap up in a few minutes. One last sort of anecdote for the difference between compassion and empathy. If you're walking down the street and there's a little pond or something or a lake and there's a child drowning in there or appears to be drowning, you don't need anything but compassion, right? You see the person is suffering and you run and you help them. You don't need any empathy. You don't need to think, huh, that person's probably really scared or they're probably really struggling. And I understand that. And then now I feel their emotion and their fear. No, you can do your job compassionately and do it just as well or better without ever, you know, relying on empathy. The point of this is just that empathy, the emotional part of empathy, can be a very deceptive guide, and don't rely on it.
Yeah, and Chaplain Clancy makes a good point too, and he says that he does believe compassion can be taught, and that it at least could be modeled, which I think that can go back with on-the-job training or just how you guys set up your organization.
And compassion can be taught. I mean, there are studies that show that compassion can be taught via various means. So it's just like I used to think that empathy couldn't be taught, and that's clearly can be, and so can compassion. How many? Two, three more? Okay, so we'll go a little bit more quickly. So get collateral and background information. This, you guys should all know that. Do you want
to add? Yeah, if it's safe to do this. I mean, sometimes, you know, the call comes out and you have to act. But if you have the time and you know that the scene is secure and things like that, look for the collateral information, the neighbors, the family, and the background, anything that you can have. And then it ends.
This is the end of the session. No, we should just end here. Sure. A quick story. There was a collateral information is essential for suicide assessments. So if someone's needing help or they're ambivalent or they're wanting help and they call and the police come, they're going to tell you, yeah, I'm thinking about killing myself, and then you can take them in. But if they truly, truly want to kill themselves, you guys are the enemy. You're going to mess up their plan. So in that sense, you'll go there, oh, I'm fine. Oh, no, thank you, officers. Thanks so much for coming. I'm fine. Well, we called about, there was a suicide call. Oh, yeah, no, that's a misunderstanding. If you don't then talk to the spouse, the neighbor, the kid, or somebody else, you're going to miss something absolutely essential, potentially.
And it's the same if you're doing an investigation. And sometimes I think people get overwhelmed with the idea of doing assessments as officers with people living with mental illness, but it's the same as any investigation. Get as much info as you can. Do your interviews that you can. And, you know, get enough probable cause that you can either take them to the hospital or you feel safe enough to leave them there. But it is one of the few calls that I can guarantee that you have the ability to save someone's life on either suicide or because of their behaviors due to a mental illness.
Okay, this is our final slide, but it's probably, and I think it's a good one to end on because it's probably the most important. So the whole point about pausing is to, and that whole digression about empathy is important because you want to be aware of your emotions. You want to be aware of your empathy. If you're being tugged and pulled by empathy, you can't just make that emotion go away. But if you know what it is and you can understand what's happening, it only takes really one breath to realize, okay, this person's playing on my heartstrings and I don't want to do something stupid because of it. Like what you were saying about giving up safety, you know, oh, it's just a little old lady or whatever, and she reminds you of your grandmother, and you're not aware of that, and next thing you know, you're over there hugging her or something.
Yeah.
So really take a moment throughout the day and also while you're on a call or anything, just to check in with yourself and what are you feeling at that moment, and how is that emotion drawing you and pushing you and causing you to act in ways that you might not have thought were possible.
No, I agree. I think the, you know, handling our emotions can be hard, especially I feel bad, at least for our agency, for our field guys, because it's just calls and calls and calls stacked on each other. It's hard to take that break and just even be aware of your own emotions. And so sometimes we just put on that face and just hide and just take everything in.
And when you're in you know, we talk so much about de-escalation and using the 7 active listening skills to calm somebody else down. But if you're not calming yourself down and staying focused, it's not going to work at all.
So again, I mean, this is a four-part thing. And so we only are really just touching the surface on this, but so we can go into more detail. And so does anyone have questions about this first part, which is just mainly about, this could even be considered like when you're putting on your uniform, getting ready. Know how you feel that day. Know what's in front of you or en route to the call. Just being aware of all that stuff. Any questions on this part?